You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. On October 2, 2018, Saudi dissident and Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi Arabian embassy in Istanbul to pick up documents for his upcoming wedding. While his fiancée nervously waited outside for hours, Khashoggi was ambushed, suffocated, and dismembered by a 15-member squad of Saudi assassins. The official line from the Saudi government was that it was an unfortunate accident. But investigations by the Turkish police and the United Nations, as well as human rights organizations, the U.S. Congress, and virtually every member of the global free press, determined that it was a deliberate execution ordered from the man at the very top, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, often referred to simply as MBS. Now, Academy Award-winning director Brian Fogel unravels the deeper mystery surrounding Khashoggi's murder and the extraordinary efforts that MBS will take to silence his critics in a gripping new documentary thriller called The Dissident. And today, Brian returns to the podcast to discuss how Jamal Khashoggi went from being an insider in the Saudi royal family to a harsh critic of the House of Saud, what he learned from friends, allies, and the fiancé of the Saudi dissident, and how a sophisticated cyber hack and the ultimate Twitter war put Khashoggi squarely in the crosshairs of MBS. Brian reveals why no major Hollywood film distributor or streaming service would even touch his movie despite the widespread acclaim for the dissident. He explains how the Saudi royal family's massive sovereign wealth fund turns dollars into censorship and calls out everyone from major U.S. corporations to President Trump for cowering and kowtowing to Mohammed bin Salman. Plus, we talk about the gruesome audio of Jamal Khashoggi's execution that emerged shortly after his death, who might have been responsible for those recordings, and whether MBS may finally suffer consequences for this brutal murder once President-elect Biden takes office. Coming up with Oscar-winning filmmaker Brian Fogel in just a moment. Today, I'm happy to welcome back to the show Brian Fogel, the Oscar-winning filmmaker behind the 2017 documentary Icarus, which blew the lid off of Russia's state-sponsored Olympic doping program. Now, Brian Fogel has a new film about the 2018 assassination of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The movie is called The Dissident, and it's showing in theaters currently and available on video on demand January 8th. Brian Fogel, welcome back, man.
Good to be talking to you again, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, last time we spoke just before Icarus came out, and I'm so thrilled to now welcome you back as an Academy Award winner. I mean, that must have happened fast to get all these awards and acclaim on your first documentary effort, in fact. So has it been a pretty quick ride?
Yeah, it's surreal, and I'm very humbling.
Yeah, I'll bet.
You know, you going through that experience and what really was, you know, like a 9-month kind of award campaign leading up to the Academy Awards. By the time I got there, I felt like there was an elephant on me, and to have such an accolade is very humbling. And I continue that, you know, you always hear, I'd like to thank the Academy. And now I understand what that means.
And you might be saying it again soon. So, because now you're out with this new documentary, The Dissident, about the assassination of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. What interested you in this story?
Following Icarus, I felt that a burden, a moral obligation to continue to tell stories that resonated in truth and impact. And the journey of Icarus, you know, when you take out the filmmaking of it, was essentially helping to save a man's life, protecting a whistleblower, bringing him into protective custody, working with law enforcement agencies and a fallout of this huge global scandal that was not only real, you know, his life, Gregory's life, is and was to this day under threat and in jeopardy. And when I've been able to communicate with Gregory over the last few years through his lawyers or through security, the conversation always starts with, "Hey, Gregory, how are you?" And he goes, "I'm alive." And I go, "That's great." And he goes, "You know, yeah. Brian, you saved my life." As silly as that sounds, I took and take that very seriously. And so I was trying to figure out what that next film was going to be, what that next story was going to be that I could go fully into, that I could immerse myself in. And as the murder of Jamal Khashoggi unfolded in the media those first 2 weeks of October 2018, it checked all these boxes, you know, and that I had set out, you know, in my, you know, mind of the story that I would want to tell it. Human rights, freedom of press, freedom of journalism, freedom of speech, a dissident being silenced for having an opinion. Hatice Cengiz, his fiance, and her emotional toll to basically not only come to grips with this horrendous murder, but then to carry on his voice and become his fighter for truth. Omar Abdulaziz, the young Saudi dissident living in Montreal in self-exile, who not only, you know, blames himself for Jamal's murder because of the work that they were doing, but he himself has his brothers imprisoned and being tortured, and his friends imprisoned with no charges simply for knowing him. And then, of course, what has come of this, which is, you know, no action, no accountability, no punishment, essentially because money and power trump truth and human rights. And so as I dove into this, and I really started the day that Saudi Arabia finally admitted to murdering Jamal or killing, or that he died in the consulate, was the day that I decided I wanted to see if I could make this film. And it really hinged on whether or not Hatice, Omar, and ultimately the Turkish government, would participate and grant me that exclusive access and information and evidence that would allow me and my creative team to tell and craft this story and go on that journey.
And one of the consistent themes in the movie is the unwillingness of so many people, particularly major authority figures, even the President of the United States, to speak out against the Saudi government, which was blatantly behind this murder. I think that's been proven by now. Was it difficult to find people who were willing to put their face in front of a camera and speak out publicly against the Saudi government?
Well, as you see in the film, the people that I have in the film is Hatice Cengiz, his fiance, right? I mean, that's she is speaking out not against the Saudi government, she is speaking out for justice for Jamal, for punishment, for some sort of consequences for this horrendous murder. Omar Abdulaziz has already been speaking out against the Saudi government, and that is why they hacked his phone. That's why they hacked Jamal's phone. So this is what he's done. The Turks, you know, have done everything they can to hold Saudi Arabia and MBS and the kingdom accountable for this murder, which, despite all of their efforts and evidence and the audio and, you know, and surveillance cameras, they have been completely unsuccessful in having, you know, any meaningful impact or punishment for this crime. And then, you know, the others in the film are, you know, are Jamal's friends, like Hoda Kanfar and Turan Kislaki. So those are the people that are, you know, are a part of the film, which is, you know, Jamal's friends and those and people that loved him and the Turks who investigated his murder.
Yeah. And you mentioned the tapes. Shortly after the murder, the CIA announced that they had audio of the execution that was handed over by the Turkish authorities. You included excerpts from the transcript of those tapes. And I'm curious, have you had an opportunity to personally listen to the recordings? And if so, what was that like?
I spent 7 months in Istanbul and, you know, back and forth to Ankara, where the seat of government is, in making this film in 2019, and built a lot of trust with the Turkish government. And what you see in the film, which, you know, a lot of people would not be aware of, is the president's spokesman, Fahrettin Altun, has never spoken about this case or murder publicly other than in this film. The police, the CSI investigator, Recep, and the chief prosecutor, Irfan Fidas, or the justice minister, Avrahimi Gul, I mean, none of these people have spoke on camera about this murder. And so this is not only exclusive to the film, there are revelations in the film that have not been made public. And one of the biggest pieces that I was able to get that CNN, the BBC, you name it, do not have, is the Turks handed over, after about a year of working with them, the 37-page transcript of his murder. And that transcript is, you know, is all the audio that they deemed relevant in the days of planning the murder itself, and then the cleanup of that murder. And they offered, as I was completing the film, to have me listen to the audio. And they even offered that they would provide some excerpts from the audio, which they have not released anywhere in the world yet. But the Turks saw that this film could have a big global impact, and if they were going to do it, this would be a, you know, right medium to do it. I made the choice instead to take that 37-page transcript and turn that into its own kind of scene, you know, that unfolds like a thriller and, you know, edge of your seat, but it's all real.
Yeah.
And use music and sound and lighting and graphics and motion graphics and texture and design, but instead lean on the words of Agnes Callamard, the UN Special Rapporteur, who heard the recordings, and Irfan Fidas, the chief prosecutor, who heard the recordings, to basically illuminate that in front of the transcript, because I felt that having the actual audio in the film would be gratuitous.
Right.
It would suddenly feel like gruesome. It was like a snuff film or something.
Yeah.
It didn't need it. And I also wanted to protect Hatice.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want her have to see that film and to hear that.
Yeah.
And I think that the way that we've put that transcript together and that is incredibly impactful. And it just felt like that added audio really wasn't necessary.
Yeah. And one thing that I've never been clear on, how did the Turkish authorities get a hold of the audio? Were these recorded by the Saudis and confiscated during the investigation? Was there a bug in the room or some kind of covert audio surveillance going on? Does anyone know?
The Turks, look, I think all intelligence agencies, yeah, right?
They're not saying.
We'll never tell you how they got what they got, but they got enough. It. You know what I mean? And a meeting with the Turks, I mean, it was, you know, I sat with Turkish intelligence, which was amazing. Yeah. I mean, because of the relationships that were developed. And, you know, one of the meetings I came to, they showed up with a dossier all, you know, like with tabs in it going, what do you want to know? and they would going back and forth. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, clearly their intelligence operations worked. Yeah. Their surveillance operations worked. There is no doubt as to this evidence. I mean, there is no doubt as to who was, you know, involved in the murder. But how they actually obtained that recording, I mean, the assumption obviously is that it was a Turkish bug in the consulate, in that media room, because Saudis came and swept the consulate for bugs 2 days ahead of Jamal's murder, and they didn't find that bug. And they only had one bug in the consulate, and that was in the media room. But was it a Turkish bug? Maybe another country put
maybe
it there.
Maybe ours.
How? Yeah. I mean, how? Where? How
but
did
we
they
don't
have
do
it?
That? Do we?
We do not know. What we do know is that they had it.
Yeah.
And not only did they have it, you know, it was the only reason why this story was able to come forward to the world. It was the only reason why Saudi Arabia admitted finally that he had been murdered. And it was truly the smoking gun. And I think when you look at, you know, Turkey's reasoning behind wanting to, you know, really go after this, there was all these, you know, conversations of, oh, well, you know, Turkey and Saudi Arabia aren't allies. And, oh, there's economic interests. Oh, and they're trying to shake down the Saudis for money or this. That was not true. Because had Turkey wanted to just accept a bribe, they had the ability to do that. And once the Saudis understood that they had the audio, my understanding is there were serious attempts made, essentially, by the Saudis to silence
Interesting.
It. Turkey and Erdogan and the government literally, you know, basically said, how dare you come into our country, murder someone on our land, in your own consulate, and then try to blame it on us?
And all the evidence seems to point to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as the person at the top who approved the murder, but he continues to claim that he had no prior knowledge of this plot, and it was just a case of some rogue actors who took things a little too far. Now that you've delved so deeply into this case, is there any doubt in your mind that MBS had prior knowledge of the plot and, in fact, gave the order?
Look, I don't know that for a fact. But what I do know, and I think what anybody knows that has common sense, right, is that you go, okay, this is a kingdom, right? This isn't even like a president where you could have culpable deniability, right? This is a kingdom. And in a kingdom, it is ruled by one man. King Salman is basically he's the king, but he's, you know, not in good health. He's in his 80s. He's, you know, all power is in the hands of his son, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, right? And everybody who works for the government essentially works for Mohammed bin Salman. So the idea that you could fly private jets owned by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, bring over, you know, your personal security. I mean, Mutreb, who was the head of the operation, is Mohammed bin Salman's personal security.
Wow.
You know, bring over the the coroner, the head, the royal coroner of the family, Al-Tubagi, who performs autopsies and knows how to dissect a body, that you can involve al-Asiri and know that that these high-ranking generals and officials are involved in an operation where they're using diplomatic passports and private jets. I mean, how on earth could this happen without the authorization of the prince? I mean, heads would roll. I mean, really? Somebody would go, hey, we're going to go chop somebody up in a consulate. We'll tell the prince later. I mean, it's unfathomable. It can't, it's especially in that country.
Off with your head.
I mean, you could possibly have culpable deniability that, whatever, a top general made a decision to take out a target, a U.S. target in Iran or something. And then go back to, Trump and say, hey, we had a shot at Soleimani. We knew that you wanted him dead and we took it.
Interesting. Oh.
And there could be a world that, that the president, wasn't aware. This is not that situation. Yeah. And I think as the film lays out very clearly, that sure, you can always have deniability, but I don't think that it is realistic.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment.
I kind of had the thumbnail sketch of who Jamal Khashoggi was. He was a reporter who was, sort of in exile from Saudi Arabia and reporting for the Washington Post, outspoken critic of the House of Saud. But I had no idea that prior to that, for about 30 years, he had been very much an insider in that government and essentially the Saudi royal family's favorite journalist. So when did that relationship start to sour?
Well, I think you see in the film, right? Here's a guy that was educated in the West. I mean, he went to Ohio State. He was fluent in English. He knew how to basically, back in Saudi Arabia, he'd wear the traditional dress and, and yet when he came to the West, here's a guy, dressed in, a suit and tie, or a t-shirt and jeans, right? He was, he had spent his life, probably, the majority of his life, back and forth between Washington, back and forth between London, right? He understood how democracies worked. He understood how freedom of speech works, freedom of press, freedom of journalism. And he accepted that, okay, in my country, it's not going to be like that. But prior to Mohammed bin Salman taking power, as we see in the film, as he does this whole siege and arrests all of his family and anybody doing business in a mafioso-style shakedown, where he brings them all into the Ritz-Carlton and, basically tortures them and basically, goes, you're going to give me half your money or you're not leaving here. That what happened with Jamal is suddenly he had accepted that there was a monarchy. He'd accepted this, but he had not seen these human rights violations like this. He hadn't seen this crackdown on any voice of opposition. He hadn't seen friends being arrested for having a difference of opinion. And what we see in the film is basically Saad al-Qahtani, MBS's, top advisor, calls Jamal and goes to him, you are to be silent. Do not tweet. Do not write. Do not say anything. And if you do, we're basically going to arrest you. We're going to throw you into a jail. We're going to, And we're going to take out our vengeance on your family and, you know, and anyone who, and anyone else. And so Jamal made a decision as he saw his friends being arrested, as he saw what was happening in that country, to flee to Washington, where he already had a home. I mean, he already owned a condo in Virginia. He had for years. And then basically took a job writing for the Global Opinions for the Washington Post. And as he saw his country going down what he viewed the wrong path, and there was a story that I was told. One of his very, very close friends was a guy by the name of Osama Zamel. Again, he was educated in the West. He was going back and forth between Washington and New York. He was an economist, fluent in English, young guy. I think he's like 40 years old, wife, family back in Saudi. And he was writing about Saudi economic policy. And he disagreed with Mohammed bin Salman's decision to bring Saudi Aramco public. He disagreed with a lot of the kind of economic policies that were coming forward in Vision 2030 that he just didn't view as good for the country. And he tweeted about this. And Jamal and his group of friends were very concerned. He went back to Saudi. They told him, don't go back. He goes because his family's there. He thinks he's going to be okay. And the next day they arrest him. Osama Zamel is still jailed, facing all sorts of charges. And this arrest, as I was told through Jamal's friends, really changed Jamal from being, you know, he was writing still in support of MBS and going, hey, it can be better, but I really like MBS, to this arrest, like got him. And then his articles in the Washington Post and everything started to take a more aggressive stance in his writings and criticism of MBS, of Trump, of his policies, and really made him very vocal in going, I disagree. And what he was seeing, you know, was here's MBS, this great reformer, and they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on, you know, American PR campaigns and lobbyists and stuff to show this guy as, you know, young, hip, cool guy who likes music. And behind the scenes, he goes, wait, this guy is the worst, you know, oppressor of human rights and free speech that I've ever seen in my, you know, 60 years of being a Saudi.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great ironies of this story is that MBS, you know, had built up this image of himself as a reformer and had, as you mentioned, this idea of Vision 2030 for a more liberalized Saudi Arabia. And he felt that Jamal Khashoggi was a threat to that, and that's why he had him killed. But by killing Khashoggi, he basically blew up Vision 2030 and destroyed his whole image as a reformer.
You know, that's exactly right. And look, and this is, and this has continued. I mean, obviously, MBS's image has been greatly, damaged as a result of the Khashoggi murder, and clearly the botching of this crime. But here we are 2 years later, and there's still no punishment. There's still no sanctions. All of these businesses and companies and corporations are still doing business with the Saudis, just as they are the Chinese. We're still selling them weapons. UK is still selling them weapons. France is still selling them weapons. Germany is still selling them weapons. Right? I mean, they basically have gotten away with it.
And one of the people, or maybe one of the few people who distanced himself from MBS of all people, was actually Amazon's Jeff Bezos. I was fascinated to learn about the Bezos angle to this story. I'm guessing that he must have sacrificed a significant amount of business when he took a position on this issue against MBS.
Yes and no.
Yeah.
And then they
interesting.
They recently announced that they acquired Souq, which is the Amazon of Saudi Arabia. They are they are still doing business with the kingdom and the Emiratis. They're
really
pursuing cloud service deals, all sorts of stuff.
Really? even after Saudi Arabia personally hacked Jeff Bezos, he's willing to set that aside and still do business.
Who's distributing this film? Briarcliff
Your
Entertainment.
Film?
Right. We are being launched on video on demand. We are not on any major global streaming platform. We have no major international distributor. Mm-hmm. And every one of these companies, Amazon included, decided not to brand this as their own content or put it on their platforms. So even Jeff Bezos, where you go away, don't you have a huge knife in this fight? Jamal was your employee. He worked for the Washington Post. He hacked your phone. If you would think that there would be one global distributor for this film, it would be Amazon. Mm-hmm. But business, money, power, shareholder accountability, all that stuff gets in the way of human rights. And that's the unfortunate reality of a world that we are living in.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because I have heard that you struggled to find someone to release this movie because studios and distributors were loath to risk reprisals from the Saudi government or from MBS. What specifically were they afraid of? Because, you know, Saudi Arabia just allowed cinemas, I think, 2 years ago. So what really do they have to risk? Are American movies even playing in those movie theaters?
You can imagine watching The Dissident as the CEO or the buyer of a major media organization and going, wow, John Brennan and Anthony Ferrante, the former head of White House cybersecurity and the head of FBI, former head of FBI cybersecurity, are telling me that Saudi Arabia has the best hacking tools in the world and basically are on par with anyone because of the money that they have. Oh, look what they did against Bezos on Twitter. They launched a boycott of Amazon on Twitter. Look at the unfriendly Trump administration that is in bed with the Saudis. Right. Oh, they hacked the phone of the richest man in the world. You can imagine, you name it, CEO going, this is a terrible crime. This is a horrendous murder. Somebody should stand up for this. But that's not going to be me or my company.
Right, right. No one wants to be the next Sony hack, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is the problem that we're facing in this era of fake news, in this divided country, in what has happened, and, in the Trumpism of it, where we're seeing that, basically by lashing out at the media, lashing out at the press, denying truth, no matter what happens, railroading things, that this has lasting effects. Mm-hmm. And what I've seen, from The Dissident, for example, is that, the Netflix that distributed Icarus is not the Netflix of today. Mm-hmm. And they are a different company. Mm-hmm. They have shown themselves that they're not willing to take those risks anymore.
Right, right. With a number of movies, in fact.
And this is happening, not just to The Dissident, not just to me, but to films that take on this sort of subject matter or content that that the world, that subscribers would want to see. We know that if this was on a major streaming platform, that people would gravitate to it and watch it. It was critically acclaimed. It's a thriller. It's a murder mystery. It was constructed with big sound and music and motion graphics. And this is not your run of the mill kind of news story. Yet there are other interests being calibrated, and obviously the Sony hack and the fallout of that has spooked a lot of these companies. Clearly the Trump administration has spooked these companies. And clearly the desire for subscriber growth and business in that region and investment in that region has spooked these companies as well. And you know, the same can be said out of China too. I mean,
right.
I mean, we, exactly. Whoa. I mean, China is just as much, if not worse, of a human rights abuser than the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, yet they're all doing business with China. I mean, look what they did in Hong Kong. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But yet they're all still doing business with China. So what we're seeing is that business and money and shareholder value and all that, it very sadly trumps human rights and ultimately freedom of press and freedom of journalism and freedom of speech. And until those values realign, I think we're in for many more years of stories that tell truth to power, struggling to find big platforms.
Yeah. It really underscores something that I've long suspected, which is that most governments care very little about human rights purely from a human rights standpoint. It's just a chit to be traded for something else, and it's almost always the first thing that they're willing to sacrifice. So I share a little bit of your cynicism in that regard. And I'm curious, knowing that Jamal Khashoggi and his friends and Jeff Bezos got hacked, did you have to take a lot of extra security precautions when you made this movie? Did you encounter forces that didn't want this movie to be made and tried to stop you?
We did a lot of safe things, you know, using burner phones, keeping our edit offline. I had security generally around me in Istanbul or other, but, you know, I think of myself as a filmmaker as a journalist and as an activist, but also as an American. And I believe that that in this country, right, we still are safe. And I would hope that we continue to be safe. Because, you know, you start going after the messenger. Well, where does it stop?
Yeah.
I mean, there are thousands of journalists. Whether it's, you know, Ben Hubbard at the New York Times or Shane Harris at the Washington Post or David Ignatius. I mean, you just keep going down and down and down that have written critically about MBS or Saudi Arabia or any sort of government or human rights abuses. And so so if people like me need to look over their back, That's a scary day for all of us.
Absolutely. Well, real quickly before we go, Trump vetoed legislation passed by Congress, including many in his own party, that would have punished the Saudi government by canceling the sale of billions of dollars of weapons to them. Do you hope that the film might revive that legislation and put pressure on President-elect Biden to maybe make that finally happen?
Well, on the second anniversary of Jamal's murder, which was October 2nd, a few months ago, Biden released a statement. He put it on Twitter. And to paraphrase that, and you could look it up, he basically said, whatever, my condolences to the friends and family of Jamal. I still believe in justice for Jamal. And if elected president, one of the, top things that I will look at in my administration is reassessing the U.S.-Saudi relationship. Mm-hmm. And there have been stories just in the last several days. You can look all over that Saudi Arabia has apparently been hiring a ton of different Washington lobbying firms.
Really?
And PR and communications agencies to basically prepare for what they are viewing or thinking is going to be a unfriendly Biden administration.
Huh.
It's to be determined, but I think, what you see in the film, which was, I wanted to see to it that the film was not partisan. And so there's three U.S. politicians criticizing Trump. They're all Republicans. It's Rand Paul, it's Lindsey Graham, it's Bob Corker.
Right.
And both the House of Representatives united and the Senate united from both sides of the aisle basically said, we want sanctions on Saudi Arabia, and we want to block the weapons sales. And Trump vetoed it. So this was not the choice of Congress, the will of the American people. This was one man basically vetoing legislation and standing in the way of the will of Congress. And so, you know, I do believe that, you know, a Biden administration, which I think he's going to have a lot of problems in office trying to get legislation passed. But I think this is one that he is not going to have a problem getting legislation passed if he chooses to pursue that.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear that there's at least some glimmer of hope that there might be at least a modicum of justice here. Well, once again, The Dissident is currently playing in theaters and available on paid video on demand starting January 8th. Brian Fogel, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Ben. It's a pleasure. I hope your listeners will find the film. You know, there's a lot of ways to take action. The Human Rights Foundation funded this film through donations, and their mandate is basically to support human rights abuses all over the world. And this film would have not been possible without them. And so on HRFHumanRightsFoundation.org, you can find information about how to get involved to not only seek justice for Jamal, but the tens of thousands of Saudi political prisoners and activists that remain in prisons in Saudi Arabia for doing nothing more than wanting their country to be a better place.
Yeah, it's an incredibly compelling film. I can't recommend it enough to the folks listening. And by all means, do like you said and take some action if you feel inspired by what you see. Brian Fogel, thanks. Stay safe, sir.
Thanks, Ben. Be well.
Thanks again to Brian Fogel for coming on the show. The Dissident is currently showing in select theaters and available on paid video on demand starting January 15th. For showtimes and more information, visit thedissident.com. Help support the Human Rights Foundation at hrf.org and follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Fogel. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.